One struggle, one fight, human freedom and animal rights. It's a motto you're more and more likely to hear people chanting in the streets, at rallies, marches, or sidewalk protests. But for many, it's more than just a slogan. A growing number of people are talking about how oppression between humans is connected to the way we treat other animals. A lot of dialogue and activity has focused on how feminism is connected to the liberation of other animals. Is the liberation of people who are identified as women bound up with animal liberation? Within the animal rights movement, some activists are challenging others to look at how equality between humans is related to animal defense.
Just generally speaking, it seems like humans take a backseat to animals, and that doesn't seem quite right to me. I think it could seem like it could happen faster if there's a hierarchy. It can seem like there's more direction in the short term, but in the long term, no.
For some people, simply starting to think about how feminism and animal liberation are connected can spark a whole string of buried intuitions.
Those connections are really, really clearly obvious. Once we kind of read just a couple of things or have a couple of conversations, it becomes so clear.
I asked Melanie Joy, an activist and educator in Boston, what triggered her sense that feminism and animal rights are linked.
I remember when I was in high school, I was one of those kids with buck teeth and braces and glasses, and I was too skinny for my nose, and my clothes never fit right. And I, earlier in high school, and once my braces came off and I got contact lenses and I gained some weight and grew into my face, all of a sudden people wanted to be my friend. And I had this power bestowed upon me that I had never before experienced. And it was at that moment in my life that I recognized that as a woman, my power, at least what I was taught, came from being the kind of visual object that that men wanted to see, and unfortunately other women. As a woman myself, having experienced on a daily basis, an hour-to-hour basis sometimes, what it feels to be an object, I started becoming more sensitized to the objectification of all women and the way that animals are literally objectified in this world and making those connections. Always, all my life, walking into a pet store thinking, you know, how can you buy someone? How can you sell someone? Why do we call them it? And I've just, I see the connections everywhere. Can't really be narrowed down. And of course, animals who are slaughtered for their flesh are literally not only objects, but they're pieces of objects, they're fragments, they're legs, thighs.
Carolyn Zykowski, also from Boston, said she started to connect feminism with animal rights after high school.
I started thinking about it more and more as my feminism kind of evolved, and I started realizing that, you know, all the times I had ever been objectified and been used or seen as a sexual object, and all the times I had been exposed to the objectification of women that I felt like meat, and that I knew how it felt, at least on a metaphorical level, to feel like a piece of meat. And then I started really learning about, you know, women's fights for reproductive freedom and abortion access, and I realized, like, oh my God, you know, if you, like, just cross the species barrier, you see that, like, it's, like, the same issues, this lack of, like, bodily autonomy, and I really started making all these connections. It was just amazing to me because I had never thought about it before.
Patrice Jones, who coordinates the Global Hunger Alliance and also operates the Eastern Shore Chicken Sanctuary in Maryland, describes how these two forms of domination started to overlap in her way of looking at the world.
My partner and I had been donating whatever little money we had to animal organizations, and it started to be getting in the mail these very disturbing pieces of literature about all kinds of animal abuse, such that my partner Miriam was having nightmares about vivisection every night, and it was becoming evident that this was something we had to think about a lot more than we had thought about before, when we had just sort of thought about animal issues as something separate from the rest of our lives. And at some point, it just suddenly hit me in the course of my reading that speciesism and sexism were so deeply linked, both in historical fact and in ideology and practice, that I couldn't untangle them. And that together, along with subjugation of Earth, they form the pattern that was then used to shape all other subsequent forms of oppression among people, such as oppression on the basis of religion or ethnicity or what later came to be called race. When I had this realization, that along with the new things that I was learning about the ways that animals are treated led me to shift from being vegetarian, which I had been since I was a teenager, to becoming vegan. Prior to that, I simply hadn't understood.
Animals and women might endure similar types of oppression in part because public images, like on billboards or in magazine ads, often associate them with one another. And these visual juxtapositions tend to promote sexual objectification.
There's one I always see, and it's on the highway in Boston. I think it's an alcohol advertisement, but it's basically this, you know, very beautiful model, and like there's a strip down the middle of her face that's ripped out, and it's like a tiger in its place. And so, you know, basically it's like half woman, half tiger face. But, you know, the implication of the advertisement is clearly if you get her drunk, she'll act like an animal or a wild animal who needs to be tamed. Which is, I think, you know, that's a really common theme, especially in alcohol advertisements, just like the idea of taming women. And then there's like the opposite theme, which you actually see a lot in like food and dairy advertisements, actually, and egg advertisements and things like that, which is like the domesticated woman as animal, or like the domesticated animal, the cow or the chicken or whatever, who is clearly drawn or like made up to be a female. So there's like this blending of the domesticated woman and the domesticated animal.
Both women's bodies and animals' bodies in advertising are often pictured in only partial form, focusing our consciousness on the parts of their bodies that are useful, either for sex in the case of women, or consumption in the case of animals. Susan Solomon, co-founder of Boston Feminists for Animal Rights, explains.
Instead of seeing them as one whole sentient creature, we see them as parts.
Women of color, says Carolyn, are more heavily stereotyped in this way than white women.
You see it so much, just like the African-American woman dressed up like in a way which implies she's a tiger or a wild animal, again, needing to be tamed. Or, you know, like the kind of stereotypical, like, so-called exotic Asian woman in these, like, exotic animal poses or posed next to so-called exotic animals. Those are two really common themes, I think.
In general, racism motivates the way women of color are viewed and treated like animals by the dominant culture, says Patrice.
So often you hear people say they treat us like animals. They think we're like animals, and animal stereotypes are applied, and the things that are done to animals are done. Women of color who are subjected to these kinds of ideologies and practices are, in a way, victims of speciesism. Because speciesism is used as the model for racism. So, yes, absolutely, women of color, I do believe, are essentially hit twice by speciesism, both as women and as people of color. We have to unflinchingly look at how the roots of racism actually are all tangled up with speciesism and sexism.
Some common words also associate and objectify or denigrate women and animals, says Carolyn.
I think, obviously, one of the most common female-specific derogatory terms is bitch. We all know that. And bitch actually has a really interesting background because, the dog is usually considered man's best friend. So why would bitch be so insulting? And it's very interesting because the bitch is actually, you know, the female breeding dog, and she's notorious for being really difficult because she doesn't want, she has to be forced to have sex with the male breeding dog. So it's a really fascinating example of the overlap of speciesism and sexism when you think about the word bitch. A lot of the female derogatory words are domesticated animals. Chick, bunny, old biddy, cow, hen, like, your henpecked. These are all like farm animals, which I think is really interesting. And then there will be words for wild animals that are female specific, like vixen or fox. And again, it's this theme all over again of like the wild woman slash animal who needs to be tamed. Usually when you think about a fox or a vixen, you're thinking about kind of a sexual prey or a really sexualized woman who needs to be hunted. So these are just a few examples. And then, of course, there's so many others. Pussy, beaver.
Reproductive control is another kind of oppression that harms animals as well as humans. Sue Abramatis of Washington, D.C. explains.
Typically, dairy cows, if left to their own devices, could live 20 to 30 years. And in the dairy industry, for instance, often they are pushed at such high production rates that they are spent after about 2 years. It's essentially taking the animal and reducing it to its production components and ignoring its abilities as a sentient being. Pigs are inseminated, and then in large-scale industry, they are housed in very small, narrow crates called gestation crates. And after they've had their piglets, they are moved. They're rotated back and forth between gestation and farrowing crates. So they essentially spend the majority of their short lives in intensive confinement and are really only removed to be inseminated or to be relocated.
Chrissy Vandenberg, an organizer with Vegan Action in Richmond, Virginia, says other activists have asked her how human reproductive freedom is consistent with animal rights.
I would be asked when I was tabling by folks what my stance was on abortion in particular, because being an animal rights person and talking about animal welfare, and animals' rights to not suffer and a right to live their lives happy, then invariably I was often asked about my stance on abortion and whether I was pro-life or pro-choice.
Both milk and eggs are mass-produced by controlling and manipulating chickens' and cows' reproductive systems. Carolyn explains it further.
The whole dairy industry is based around female bodies being hooked up to horrible machines that are designed to suck milk out of the female body. To me, that couldn't be any more relevant to feminism. The whole meat industry, really, is based around the control of bodies and the control of reproductive systems and sexuality, not just of females, but of animals in general. But with females, there are specific instances of, like, you know, they're inseminated and inseminated and inseminated over and over and over again. And this is their entire life cycle until they can't do it anymore. And their children are taken away from them time and time again. And just all these things that if they were happening to human women would be completely be feminist issues. But because there's that speciesism in the feminist movement, and because we have such a hard time seeing across that species border, we don't recognize them as issues of feminism. I heard that the place where they artificially inseminate farm animals and lab animals is called the rape rack. And that was when it really just, like, all the puzzle pieces came together for me. Because it was just amazing to me to find out that they called it the rape rack, that this wasn't just a feminist thing. This wasn't, like, feminist propaganda. Like, this was from inside the minds of farmers and scientists and people who make their living abusing animals, that they actually consider this on some level an invasion of sexuality and rape. They call it rape.
Susan, a clinical psychologist who counsels women breaking out of violent relationships, says that women and animals are also treated similarly by abusive partners. Her own childhood reflected how these things overlap.
I experienced a lot of domestic violence, which affected, I had several cats and it ended up affecting them as well. But I never really was able to put a name to that and to recognize that the cats had been hurt as well. A lot of the women I work with are survivors of sexual violence and physical abuse themselves. And they innately connect with the powerlessness, I think, that animals feel, and often feel a deep connection to their companion animals and will often cite them as the one source of unconditional love in their lives. Men who batter will use violence against women's companion animals as a specific tool for degradation and for control and for instilling fear. It just creates such a culture in the house of just such a lack of respect for life and for the bond that woman will share with that animal, and also lets the woman know that she could be next. I have spoken with survivors throughout my, 10 plus years of work in the domestic violence movement who hesitated to leave because they were unable to bring their companion animals to shelters, and they were unable to, completely verify that animal safety. And, most of them said they wouldn't put it past the batterer to also hurt the animal.
Carolyn adds to the topic.
There have been a few studies done which show that roughly 80% of women who are in domestic violence shelters in the United States have also witnessed abusive companion animals at the hands of their abusers. Yet, I think it's only 6% of domestic violence shelters in the United States have joint programs with animal abuse shelters. This is a problem that I see as mainly being speciesism in the feminist movement, and the anti-domestic violence movement not analyzing speciesism and not validating women's relationships with their companion animals. So many women won't go to domestic violence shelters because they don't want to leave their companion animals with their abusers. So many women have relationships with these animals.
Reproductive control, visual objectification, demeaning epithets, and domestic violence are all supported by a general way of looking at animals and women as inferior. Patrice talks about this.
Any time a group of people wants to subjugate another group of people, they do two things. They feminize them and they animalize them. By feminization, I mean the attribution to a group of people of traits that are believed to be feminine, such as passivity or lack of intellectuality. By animalization, I mean the attribution to a group of people of traits that are believed to be naturally held by animals, such as being controlled by your instincts rather than having thoughts, such as being insensible to pain, those sorts of things.
Marty Keel, who co-founded a national group called Feminists for Animal Rights in the 1980s, describes a patriarchal worldview that associates animals and women.
It's the same patriarchal mentality that says that you are part of this natural world that's less than the divine, the sacred, the rational, all those things that are outside of the earth and that are seen as superior. You're the irrational, you're the evil, you're the profane. For me, I keep coming back to this idea of masculine self-identity and how it's all about men establishing their identity in opposition to women in nature and animals. And that, to me, is the most important thing that needs to be challenged. We need to really get to the roots of that and to start teaching children, young boys in particular, at a very young age, to not see their identity as opposed. This whole construct of women and nature as the other.
All of this plays out in the animal rights movement when girls and women are silenced by men at meetings and actions, says Laura Lungarelli from Long Island.
I've been at meetings where there have been 7 women sitting around and 1 man, and the man has spoken the entire time and not given a single female the chance to speak, and he actually would have the audacity to go ahead and say that the group was sexist because he was the only man. He would try to say that it was sexist because he was the one being oppressed, and I would just simply look at him and be like, who has done all the speaking? You have done more speaking than 7 women combined. Things like that happen often. Things like who's always on the bullhorn whenever you're out at a demo. It's generally a man, and who's always quick to go talk to someone or, anyone, be it news or someone that we're protesting. It's a man who fronts the whole group.
Marty agrees that there's still a lot of unchallenged sexism in the animal rights movement.
I think we have a lot cut out for us. I recently talked to a woman who's doing research on the animal rights movement, and her personal view, based on her research, was that there was more machismo in our movement than in other movements, such as the global movement and the different progressive movements.
Carolyn describes her experiences as an animal rights activist.
There are a lot of vegetarians and vegans and animal rights activists who are pro-life, and I say that in quotation marks. So I think the hardest thing for me has been trying to talk to certain vegetarians or animal rights activists about why pro-choice is a logical extension of animal rights. There's a lot of resistance to that, I think. I either get really blank stares from people who just don't know, just it's so far removed for them that it's like, how do you even begin to talk about it? Or I get really defensive people.
One of the most widely criticized instances of sexism in the animal rights movement is the use of sexualized female bodies in promotional campaigns by people for the ethical treatment of animals.
Talk about sexism in the animal rights movement, people for the ethical treatment of animals is actually pretty notorious for using this half woman, half animal image, or like the really beautiful woman dressed like in an animal-like pose, using that to promote animal rights. They really have some unchecked sexism going on there.
But on the flip side, lots of feminists have reacted to the association of women and animals by arguing that they're just as human as men. Mary Wollstonecraft in the 19th century even argued that women needed to break out of being, quote, gentle domestic brutes. One popular bumper sticker says, quote, feminism is the radical notion that women are people too. But feminism would be more radical if it embraced animal liberation, says Carolyn.
You know, it's basically a feminist mantra. We don't want to be treated like animals. I'm a woman, I'm not an animal.
Chrissy promotes a vegan diet, one without any animal products like meat, eggs, or milk, and sees it as an act of feminism.
I particularly focus on vegan issues because 98% of the animals in the world are oppressed for food production. The other 2% are things like fur, laboratory, circuses, those kinds of things. So since the majority of non-human animals are being abused and killed for food, I have focused my interests and my advocacy in veganism. And I definitely can see the clear connection between the two, between how our society treats animals and how our society treats women, again, as objects to serve the needs of society and specifically the needs of men.
Carolyn has a similar view.
I would say that veganism is the diet that is most logical to a feminist world.
In order to really integrate the movements for feminism and animal rights, people with male privilege have to constantly challenge sexism in the animal rights movement, says Adam Weissman of a group called Wetlands Preserve in New York City.
Men can't simply consider sexism a women's issue. Men need to, first of all, challenge sexism when we see it, support women having an increased voice, increased power in decision-making, and be in solidarity with them when they call out and challenge sexism in the movement. Men in the movement also need to not only look externally, but also look internally, examine our own practices and interactions, examine ways that we benefit from male privilege in terms of power, in terms of expression, in terms of organizational roles, and in terms of the deference that's given to our comments. I think it's critical for men in the movement to, within themselves, challenge tendencies towards sexual harassment, towards looking at women in the movement as a pickup opportunity, and towards objectification of women. Because sexism is perpetrated by men, it is critical for men to be a part of recognizing the problem and challenging it, just as in the case of animal liberation, because speciesism is a human problem, it is humans who must be critical in challenging it.
I also asked about some of the things people have done to create an alliance between the issues. Susan describes some actions she took with Boston Feminists for Animal Rights.
We would attend animal rights events and be an ecofeminist presence there, and attend feminist events and be an ecofeminist presence there. And on occasion, we were met with hostility for people, specifically and usually people who didn't want to quote-unquote dilute their cause with either side of that, you know, paradigm or whatever. But overall, I think what was so positive about it was to sort of be there and be a proud presence.
She even gave workshops on going vegetarian to a local Girl Scout troop.
We were invited by the Patriots Trail Girl Scouts to do seminars on how to go vegetarian. Most of the girls were already considering going vegetarian. And again, you know, what I saw was on some intuitive level, that there's something about their sensitivity to suffering and the familiar feeling of not being listened to and of being powerless, of being objectified, that I think on some gut level helped them resonate with the suffering of animals and the food industry.
The Eastern Shore Chicken Sanctuary is a home for chickens rescued from factory farms. Patrice and her partner see the sanctuary as an expression of feminism.
My partner and I moved to a rural area. We weren't here in this rural area more than a few weeks before we happened to find a chicken in a ditch. And that led us, within months, to start what is now called the Eastern Shore Sanctuary. We do consider this sanctuary to be a feminist project. How? There are a lot of different ways, ranging from just the general way that we do things, the general way that we interact with the animals who live here, to very specific things. We have quite a few hens from egg factories, and whenever we have room, we find ways to offer homes to as many hens from egg factories as we can. Whatever we are doing is a reflection of the way that we see the world and the connections. Women have always taken direct action against exploitation and for preservation, not only of themselves, but also of other species. And there are so many examples of that in history, and I'm always inspired by that. And there are so many examples of it in the present day, and I think it's important to just remember that just because we don't know it's happening, we don't read the news stories about the woman in the low-income urban neighborhood who is making it her business to make sure that nobody hurts the feral dogs that are running in the streets. We just have to recognize that those kinds of actions, whether or not they're thought of as ecofeminist actions by the practitioners and whether or not they're ever recognized as such by outsiders, are always going on.
I asked for general advice on how to make animal liberation projects more positive for women. This is what Chrissy says.
Ask questions. Ask the questions that seem like they're really obvious, but they're actually things that are taken for granted. How we can include women into different aspects. How we can be more women positive. How we can be more feminist associated and feminist oriented. And we just have to start asking those simple questions and make the animal rights and animal liberation movement more feminist oriented.
If women of color are the most caught in the crossroads of sexism and speciesism, it's especially important for animal defense activists to work on being their allies. Patrice, who worked at the Nelson Mandela Center for Anti-Racist Education, shares her advice on how white activists can do this.
The worst thing that people can do who are progressive activists about race is to ignore it altogether. But running a very close second is deal with it in an extremely simplified manner. They shy away from really talking about it. They engage in tokenization. What white people who have not dealt with race extensively before tend to do is to become extremely nervous when they start to deal with the issue of race. And this can lead to real missteps. So I think that the first thing that you have to do is educate yourself about race enough that you don't have to talk in a really simplistic manner about it because you understand the nuances of it. Secondly, stop being so nervous about it. Trust that you are in fact capable of being a good ally. Trust yourself that you'll be able to correct your mistakes and or apologize for your mistakes and move on and be a good ally to people of color in their struggle for self-determination and freedom.
In general, promoting alliances between liberation efforts can be tiring and risks backlash. Patrice says that we can't let that get in the way of combining our movements toward feminism and animal liberation.
Anytime time you start to talk about connections, to try to build bridges, there are going to be conflicts. There are going to be people who are telling you you are bad and wrong for even suggesting that we should think about these things, because there are always going to be some people who say, no, the one big problem is this, whether it's race, whether it's sex, whether it's class, whether it's environment. There are going to be people who tell you that's the one big problem. If you insist on time at the connections, you are bad and wrong with regard to that problem. You can't let that stop you. You just have to understand that that's part of the process, and that's why we call it a struggle.
London calling, speak the slang now. Boy say what? Guan girl say what? What? London calling, speak the slang now. Boy say what? Guan girl say what? What?